Next item on the agenda, item 16, Virginia Institute of Marine Science, presentation of Dr. Bob Orse, annual review of SAV.
Oh, God.
Okay, good afternoon. It's been a year since I made my last presentation, and I appreciate the time that we've given again this year to present to you annual presentation on some of the major topics of SAV that I think are pertinent to this commission. So here I'm going to cover some of the same topics I've covered before. One is to let you know what the bay-wide status is of SAV, update you on the SAV sanctuary in Chincoteague Bay, also update you on the propeller scar issue and an update on the seagrass restoration in the coastal bays, and then just identify a couple of actions needed today by the commission. Okay, we monitor SAV bay-wide every year, and just I wanted to give you an update on where we are in 2009, which is this number here. I have this in hectares, but to give you a reference, we go back and forth between hectares and acres, but we're presently at around 86,000 acres of SAV bay-wide. You can see that over the time course from when we started monitoring in 84 through this time period that we've had some ups and downs. We're on an up cycle. Our big concern is that when you look at the next couple slides, these cycles are very different depending on where you are in the bay. Again, the Chesapeake Bay has a restoration goal. That is a goal set by the regulators of the Chesapeake Bay of approximately 185,000 acres. And the 2009 total is only 46% of that. So the 2010 goal has not been met. And what happens hereafter, again, is all part of the big issue surrounding what happens within the Chesapeake Bay, not just for SAV, but a lot of the other issues that we're facing. But again, my intent here is just to give you a quick update of where we are in this particular issue and then some of the subsequent issues that we have here. And why I bring this up, I mentioned this last year and several years, the Virginia water quality standards now include SAV as an attainment of Chesapeake Bay water clarity standards. That is, the water quality standards include a component for water clarity, and in meeting those standards, they include how much SAV there is in different parts of the bay. So in a way, in meeting these standards, as I've said before, really every acre counts. We get requests from the Virginia DEQ, and it's particularly interesting in the Potomac River, because in the Potomac River, if you know where the boundary is, they want to know exactly where that line is, because Virginia wants to count every single acre in the Potomac River for Virginia and not in Maryland. It's kind of a very amusing story just because of how that boundary is between Virginia and Maryland. But this gets to be a very sticky issue because, again, every acre is going to count as we move towards, the issues of just how clean does the bay really get and where we are in SAV. I wanted to show you, again, some of the trends that we see for the entire Chesapeake Bay for different salinity zones because we have different species around the bay based on how much salt it can tolerate. The most fascinating thing has been what's been happening in the freshwater areas, tidal freshwater areas, and these are the areas that are currently in blue. When we first started monitoring, there were only about 2,000 hectares, and we've seen this huge rise in freshwater or low salinity grasses. This has all been driven actually by what happens here at the head of the bay, the Susquehanna Flats, which was, sort of the one of the more important freshwater areas for ducks, waterfowl. That has been returning dramatically. But we have seen some very interesting increases here in the James, principally the Chickahominy, the Pamunkey, and the Mattapani. These are being driven by an invasive called hydrilla in some of these systems. But we also have seen the return of many native species amongst the hydrilla populations. So the freshwater plants are doing really well. The medium salinity zone, which encompasses a very large part of the bay and tribs, we started out very low, and there's been a very dramatic up and down swing. And the problem we have here in the mid-bay is that in the past we've had four or five species. We now only have just one, which is widgeon grass, which is a very dynamic species that comes and goes, and that's why we're seeing these wild swings in this particular area. And what's interesting, I got a call from Ken Smith, who's president of one of the Worms Association, which was, happened back in July, and he said there was more grass in the Potomac, the upper lower Reedville area and in the Rappahannock, and it really is all ridge and grass. It's been coming back like gangbusters, but we've also seen these big swings, so what happens today can be very different than what we see tomorrow. The part that has been a concern to us in the lower bay here, in particular for juvenile blue crabs, is this issue here where we started low, we've gone up, down, up, down. We're on an up cycle, and this low portion was due to that big dive back in 2005 when the summer was really hot, and actually, believe it or not, it was hotter back then than it was this summer in some parts of the summer. So we see these very different changes in different parts of the bay, and it's important to understand those changes in relation to the species. And why I put this little area in the box is this. This is the Mobjack Bay, and if I go back one, this is one of the segments. The Chesapeake Bay has divided the Chesapeake Bay into a whole bunch of different segments, and these restoration goals are unique to each particular segment, and this is one of those segments, the Mobjack Bay. And so here's the SAV abundance over time. It was very low, then it got up higher, and then went down a low, and now we're seeing that increase, as I showed you, in the last 4 years. This is the 2010 goal. It's roughly a little over 6,000 now. This is in acres. And so we're still well short of that 2010 goal. Now, what does this mean? Right now, I think there's an unknown, but the fact is that the bay is being pushed, or the states are being pushed to improve water clarity, water quality. And not meeting these goals, I think, still is an unknown. And maybe Tony Watkinson, who's now chief of the habitat, might be able to comment on that, because not meeting the goals may mean certain restrictions in these particular segments. And Tony, you may want to comment more on that if the commission cares to. But again, every single segment, and there's 80 segments in the bay, they have these, each segment has an SAV restoration goal. And so, you know, we're watching that carefully, and we work very closely with VMRC and DEQ regarding what's going on there. So again, this is just to keep you kind of in the place of what's happening in the bay with regard to this, because it may come back in other issues that relate to restrictions in certain areas. Okay, moving on to the, and I'll answer questions. If you have any questions as we move along, please don't hesitate to ask as we move this, because this, there's a lot of stuff in this presentation. Certainly would like to answer any questions if you have it as we move along. The Chesapeake Bay SAV sanctuary was developed because we saw some damage to these beds from dredging for clams. The commission approved a sanctuary that protected the grass beds. And what we've seen over time due to appropriate enforcement and perhaps fewer dredgers, that once we establish the sanctuary with these marker boundaries, we've seen essentially no more damage to the grass beds in Chincoteague Bay. But, so that's a big plus. The propeller scarring issue, this is an update on where we are through the 2009 aerial monitoring program. Again, these were propeller scars primarily from the Hall Seine fishery. We've concentrated our monitoring efforts on only two sites, the Browns Bay and the Pocosin River area. This doesn't mean that scarring doesn't occur in other areas. We watch that carefully, but we've been using funds to monitor these sites really intensively. And as we've seen in the past, this is what the scarring looked like back in the 1990s. These beds were being heavily damaged by propeller scars as the nets were being brought inshore, the two different nets here, two sides of nets. These are the data, and again, graphically, scar length on the y-axis, year from when we started monitoring. The peak for a particular year represents the number of the linear distance of scars that we saw each year, and followed all those same scars the next year. And as you can see from just following one particular line, the scars recover very quickly as long as they're not continually damaged. These areas, as long as they're not damaged, you know, do okay heavily. So we established these guidelines for new Hall Seine restrictions, and in the last 10 years, we've really seen propeller scarring really minimized in the Browns Bay area. The same is true in the Pocosin Flats. Again, the scarring was very heavy in the 1990s period. Again, just following one line, you can see the scars length was over 40,000 meters, and the next year they recover very quickly because there's a lot of surrounding grass in these areas. These grasses come back very quickly from seeds and vegetative growth. Scars aren't that wide that they can kind of grow together. And again, the restrictions that were placed, which weren't that great, they were essentially limiting the time that hauls can be done in these grass beds, We have seen limited propeller scarring, and it doesn't mean that there's no scarring. We do see some, but it's not anything like what we saw in the 1990s. So I think that bringing the issue and making it, you know, a point with some of the haul centers, they've responded very well in modifying the time they do their hauling in these areas. And I think that's a testament to the watermen and responded to, and to their understanding of what type of damage they were doing and trying to correct that activity. Okay, last year I brought up this particular picture. This is the Coast Guard area, and these are plots of eelgrass that we started replanting in the 2000 time period. Again, we're responding to the need for the state to have more acres of SAV. This is an area that had historically SAV prior to 1972. We started reestablishing some of these areas, and what we noticed, and this was noticed a few years earlier, but in 2009, this is a 2009 photograph, we saw these propeller scars through these grass beds. We mentioned this, or I mentioned this to you last year. I talked to Jack Travelstead soon after and said this is something that we need to watch carefully and see what happens. This is the 2010 shot, and these are the same plots. Again, there's 2009. These are plots in which we put seeds of eelgrass in different years. In some plots we reseeded, other plots we didn't. Sort of a big experiment to see whether we need to reseed areas every year or not, or if these plants can come back by themselves once they get established. So here we have, again, you know, plots that were, you know, seeded 1 year. There's the 2010, and this is when, after we received this photo, because we were concerned that the effort to reestablish eelgrass could be compromised by repeated hauling of in this area. I brought this attention to Jack Travelstead and requested a meeting with Commissioner Bowman, and this is what happened. We met, as the VIMS people met with VMRC to discuss the problem. At that meeting, there was Commissioner Bowman, Jack Travelstead, some of the officers and staff. We discussed the problem. The suggestion was that we actually meet with the Hall Saners, which we did in July. We met with a bunch of Hall Saners who worked this area, the VMRC staff and the officers, to see if we could come up with a compromise. From that meeting, we decided that it might be really good to go out to the Coast Guard site, and I did that with Rob O'Reilly, one of the staff, and Mr. West, Lionel West, who was
Lionel Jenkins?
Oh, was it Jenkins?
Yes.
Why did I say West? Oh, okay, Lionel Jenkins. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
I'll correct that.
No problem.
Okay. Anyway, we met. We went from VIMS. I took him out, took Rob, and we looked at the area where they hauled, and we said, okay, what's a good compromise? What could we set up as a line that you guys could continue hauling but also keep SAV protected? And so we sat and looked at it, and Lionel said, well, we run our nets from here to here. I said, okay, what if we put a series of stakes that you all could just run your nets in a certain, you know, kind of corridor that would minimize the disturbance? And so, you know, we went back and forth, and Lionel said, well, if we put a stake here and we put a few stakes there, we can run our nets. So in roughly 1 hour, we decided that, you know, we put in five stakes, and he said, yeah, that's pretty good. We'll work with that. So here's an aerial photograph. This is a little bit higher of the Coast Guard station. Now, I'm so used to looking at aerial photographs. If there's any question that you have about this aerial photograph, you got to let me know, because I look at these things day and night. I dream about them. I see them in my sleep. I mean, literally. And so when I talk,
we believe you too.
When I talk about aerial photographs and what we see, or what I see, and if you're not, please tell me. Okay, so what we did, you know, here are those plots. Again, this is the 2010 photograph. Here are those plots. And Mr. Jenkins said, okay, you know, we come off the pier, the Coast Guard pier, and it can only go by so close because of restrictions. And he said, we run from here to here. And I said, okay, you know, we put five stakes, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and we got a GPS, and he said, let's work with that. So it was kind of interesting, because we said we didn't want to just exclude haul sanding, because they said this was a really good area for haul sanding, and they felt they didn't want to be kept out of an area, because a lot of areas have bottom obstructions that prevent them from hauling. This is one of the areas that doesn't have a lot of obstructions. So what they do is they bring nets from one side here, and I don't know whether you can see it, but there are similar propeller scars here, but most of our grass is really coming along in here. So we said, what about, you know, setting this line up and then run, you know, in a small corridor, so you'll minimize the disturbance from your propellers. It means that there's going to be some disturbance to grass, but not to this entire area. And then what we'll be doing each year is watching what happens to the grass on this side of the line and what happens on this side of the line. And again, you know, no new regulations, just a kind of a gentleman's agreement that the haulers, and Lionel said he talked to the other haul centers and let them know, you know, where these poles are. They're big enough that they can see at night. We're going to try to put some flagging tape, maybe put some a bigger pole just so that they can see at night. But this way they'll haul in a certain direction from here to here. And this is deep water. This is all turbid water, but the break between shallow and deep is pretty sharp. So they bring their nets from the deep water here, and they bring their nets, you know, along there, and they usually set their net for hauling the fish sort of about here. So I'm hoping that, you know, this is going to work. You know, I said that let's just see how it goes, and we'll look at our aerial photography next year, and we'll see what we can do. He did ask me if we could get the staff to write to Dan Baco to remove these objects here. These are oyster racks that are still there that need to be removed, and they're actually pretty ratty, and some of them have actually been pushed out into deeper water, and I know Lionel said a few times they get their nets hung up on that. So I talked to Chip, and he said they're going to try to get a letter to Mr. Baco to get these things removed. They're no longer functional.
Well, you know, you make not just to interject real fast, you've said a couple of really important things. Number one, I think more people by human nature would rather be part of the solution than part of the problem. So if you've already gone out there and done a great job enlisting the support of the watermen that use this area and need this area, hopefully Mr. Baco, and I have no reason to think otherwise, wouldn't jump in and want to be part of the solution I'm just happy with the way y'all have engaged with the industry, and everybody's gotten together and worked out. I mean, that beats the hell out of having to come up here, excuse my French, heck, out of come up here and have to pound regulation after regulation after regulation that this can work. This is the ideal situation.
Yeah, I told Lionel, I said, listen, we're not here, you know, to say you can't do something. We don't want to do that. We felt that there are certain places that need to haul because they don't have bottom obstructions. We know that. You know, we watch every single blade of grass in the bay, so we know what's going on. We felt, let's work with them. And that's why I think we took the step, find out from you how to do it. One of the officers recommended that we meet with them, which we did. The initial meeting was a little, at first, confrontational because I don't think they fully understood what we were trying to do. But as we got through the meeting, I think they understood that. And then when I met with Lionel, it was very clear. They only needed, you know, some way to get their nets from deep water to shallow water. And this, hopefully, this small corridor along in here they'll use to be able to continue harvesting, you know, without a lot of damage. Again, we've accepted the fact there will be some damage. But if we can get a lot of the grass back, again, a lot of the damage will be ameliorated, you know, every year by the continuing production of seed. So, you know, we'll work it out and we'll see how it goes. And if it doesn't work, we'll, again, get together. So that's where we are with this particular situation. Moving on to the last part of this, which is our seagrass restoration effort in the coastal lagoons. Again, you've heard me for the last numbers of years telling you what we're doing over on the seaside lagoons where eelgrass used to be. In the 30s, completely disappeared in 33 due to the storm and some disease issues. And we've had a program to try to reestablish it. It's a seed-based eelgrass restoration effort into a number of coastal lagoons that support eelgrass and a very productive bay scallop fishery until 1933. We're working with a lot of volunteers. And again, here are some of the seeds. We simply put seeds out into areas that used to have it but no longer do, and then let nature do the rest. This is a graphic that shows on your y-axis the number of acres, the year. And so since about 2001, we have broadcast roughly 33 million eelgrass seeds into 262 acres. Nature has done the rest. And in 2010, we have over 4,000 acres of eelgrass in for these coastal bays. So what it demonstrates is that when water quality is not an issue and you have the right habitat conditions, eelgrass can spread very well, very fast and naturally. And given that, tell you, this is a shot that shows South Bay in 2004. This red polygon essentially encircles where the grass is, and in 2010 is essentially 100% eelgrass. So in, you know, less than 10 years, we've gone from no eelgrass to a lot of eelgrass, and that bodes very well for the next step of trying to introduce bay scallops. The issue that we have to deal with today is here is the Hog Island Bay set aside, in which that was approved 5 years ago. All this area here in this yellow polygon is eelgrass. You can see these plots of about 1 acre in size. Those are the plots in which we put eelgrass. This dense area now is eelgrass that's been coming back. And we've also been quite surprised that there's also been some natural recovery that we think are from plants coming down the coast in flowering shoots with seeds from Chincoteague Bay, because there are some genetic studies going on right now that suggest that probably this would have happened, you know, maybe in 100 years left alone. We've just kind of nudged nature along. So this is the set-aside. This is the current eelgrass, and again, you can see the plots. The set-aside is essentially up as of yesterday, and we've asked for an extension of that for another 5 years. Again, just to give you a kind of comparison of what's going on with Chesapeake Bay, Chincoteague Bay, and the coastal bays, these graphics show eelgrass distribution abundance in Chincoteague, the coastal bays, and the Chesapeake Bay. You've seen this kind of picture of what's happened in Chesapeake. This, of course, is the area where eelgrass used to be. I showed you this last year. It no longer is there, and that's the water quality issue that we've been talking about. Chincoteague was doing very well, has lost a lot, but coming back, and then all you have to do is look at what we're seeing in the coastal bays. The coastal bays are in here a really unique situation because, again, it's relatively protected because now all the barrier islands are essentially protected because they're owned by the Nature Conservancy, and it's just one beautiful area, and what we're seeing is essentially what nature does best, spread eelgrass. Okay, a quick update on our Bay Scallop work. Again, I commented that up until 1933, this was an area that supported a very large commercial fishery for Bay Scallops. This is the pounds harvested during at least these time periods that we can get data. Here are the dollar values then, and here are the today dollars. So you can see that during this time period, this was a very significant fishery. Primarily all tied to eelgrass. Without eelgrass, which died back in 33 August, we've seen no scallops since. We've established an initial program in trying to reintroduce bay scallops, and very simply, again, it's been extinct for 77 years. There's no local stock which can initiate restoration. Our approach has been taking broodstock from North Carolina, essentially quarantine it because there are some invasive species attached to the scallop, so we have to be very careful about reintroducing an animal from another area. We don't want to bring in any disease organisms, which are some on these bay scallops. So we're holding them in quarantine. We're spawning those in Mark Luckenbach's hatchery on the Eastern Shore, and we're putting out the juveniles into these grass beds to see how well they grow. But the numbers are so low, they're not really doing much yet. We're just learning that they grow really fast, and the habitat is perfect for their growth. Our progress right now, again, we've collected scallops from two different locations in North Carolina in 2009 and 2010. Mark has been doing some spawning. They're not easy to grow. They're one of the hardest species to grow because they don't like sediment. They like clean water, and the water coming into some of these areas is a little bit turbid. They're very, very difficult to manage because they attach to these screens, and to clean them, you've got to be very gentle. So it's a 24/7 operation raising these juvenile scallops at the Eastern Shore. We put out 12,000 scallops last year, and some in cages, some in not cages. We're watching what happens. Next year, we're ramping up the effort. We're hoping to put more out in 2011. The future, well, you know, we're hoping to do more in the succeeding years because I think it's a numbers game. Just like with eelgrass, with numbers of seeds, the more you put out, the more likely you're going to get bay scallops. And we're looking at the potential for a brand new fishery. We think it's going to take about a decade to do this if we can get more scallops out every year. The success is not guaranteed. No one has ever truly established bay scallops where they were exterminated. This is a rather unique effort anywhere in the world to reestablish a scallop fishery once it's been totally lost. We're very optimistic based on what we've seen with eelgrass and how it's reestablished and the fact that eelgrass is necessary as a settling substrate. We're happy to have this going, and so we're optimistic that this will be successful. And when this happens, and I think even before that, I think it's going to be necessary to really begin to develop a plan. How do we commercially, harvest these animals, or do we let them stay as an unmanaged stock? And I think this is something that, if our efforts in the next couple of years succeed, we'll have to get together with VMRC staff and start talking about a plan to allow some minimal harvest initially, and then similar to what's going on in New England, they've done a lot of stock enhancement up there and have had great success. So we're looking at, in the next 10 years, the possibility of a brand new fishery in the Virginia coastal bays if eelgrass does well and continues to do well. So in summary, For the bay and any of these coastal bays, water quality still is a major driver for SAV distribution, and in particular nitrogen. We've been doing some studies looking at water quality. Nitrogen is the big issue, and it overwhelms everything in the bay. So, without the clean water, and as we've seen in the coastal bays, we've compared water quality in the coastal bays where we're having success and in the Chesapeake, and there's a big difference in what we're seeing in the coastal bays, which is allowing eelgrass to really do very well. Eelgrass abundance in lower bay is still a concern to us. We're not certain how this summer of 2010 will play out. We won't know until next year. We know we've seen some populations of eelgrass, especially when we had that hot June, just die back completely. So we're going to have to wait until next year to really have a full assessment of that. The sanctuary in Chesapeake Bay and Chincoteague Bay seems to be doing very well. The enforcement and the fact that there are not many that really rely on this method of harvesting clams are around. Propeller scarring, low levels, but I think the monitoring has helped us understand, the need of watching these beds and responding quickly in situations where we have to tackle this, as we did in the Coast Guard. I think that was a good situation for us to jump in and then now work with the watermen that are using this area. There are five or six that actually call in this area, so we'll be continuing to work with those watermen for protecting eelgrass, but allowing the hall setting to continue. And then the coastal bays, well, eelgrass is doing great so far. And again, will bay scallops be next? That's what the future holds. And we're pretty excited. It's great to be able to work with something that is really, really successful. So the actions needed, again, we're going to need the approval for funding for the monitoring. It's not much. It's, I think, $20,000 a year that we request for the propeller scar monitoring. And then our set-aside in Hog Island needs to be continued. And I understand there is a letter that just arrived regarding the concerns of our continuation. So that's pretty much it. And I've gone through a lot very fast, but much of it is a continuation of what we're doing next year. Essentially all good news here, except for the water quality issue in the Chesapeake Bay, which is not that good news. So I'm here to answer any questions you might have.
Anybody have any questions for Dr. Worth? Mr. Robbins and Mr. Tankard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bob, thanks for that presentation. Has there been any success restoring eelgrass outside of the coastal bays? In other words, has there been any success in the lower Chesapeake Bay and
yes,
eelgrass restoration?
There has been. The James River, we have a successful area or areas, one just below the Monitor Mamaroneck Bridge Tunnel and one just above or below the Hampton Roads Bridge Tunnel. So where water quality is good, and where we kind of give nature a push, it does well. So that's surprisingly, a very interesting one, because who would have thought the James River would support, one of the more successful areas. So, yes, we have successful sites in the Chesapeake Bay. There's another one in the St. Mary's River. So they're scattered about. And unfortunately, the funding for a lot of this work is being short-circuited because people have been sensing that seagrass or SA restoration doesn't work. It does work, but we've been learning a lot over the last 10 years that sometimes the difference between a site that might be a kilometer away could be enough to have success versus failure. So, but yes, there are successful sites in the Chesapeake Bay of 10 years or greater.
Okay, and just to follow up, one of your slides, you indicated that water quality was a continuing threat to the SAV health in Chincoteague mm-hmm. Bay. Are there specific threats there that you had in view? Or?
There's brown tide's a big issue, which is a phytoplankton-driven organism that just grows in vast bunches, just like red tides, but it's a brown tide. There is a lot of effort to try to improve the water quality in Chincoteague Bay. And seagrass, is being used as one of the measures to look at how the system responds in terms of improved water quality.
Mr. Tankard.
I have two questions. One, you mentioned that the scallops that you were bringing in came from North Carolina.
That is correct.
And there was a quarantine period.
That is correct.
And there's some parasites that may be attached to those scallops. Mm-hmm. Is that something we need to be worried about with regard to our clam industry?
No. Mark Luckenbach has established, based on an established set of protocols, the a quarantine that follows that allows the animal to stay in quarantine, and not, there's no way anything can get out of this quarantine system. Mark Luckenbach is well respected among his peers and among the people along the Eastern Shore, and Mark would do nothing to compromise those issues in terms of the release of anything that would be harmful. So again, there's an established set of protocols for quarantining bivalves, and he's following those to the T.
Okay. And
we are well aware. That has been in a discussion in our group. I can tell you that Mark would do nothing to compromise those standards.
Mr. Tiger.
Follow-up question and with regard to the letter we have in hand. Do you think Mr. Kelly phoned me and then also sent this letter? And as you know, as you just stated, the aquaculture industry, and in particular the clam industry, is important to our economy on the shore. Do you see that one day that the clam industry will have some negative relationship to the growth of SAV on the seaside?
All I can say
or vice versa.
Yeah, right. I can say that, you know, VIM staff has worked very closely with the MRC when it comes to requests for leases in and around areas with SAV. I don't know whether Hank's here or not, but you know, we're well aware of the conflict. It has been minimized along the seaside of the Eastern Shore because most of the clam aquaculture is intertidal. There are questions emerging, I know, in talking with Mark, and there was apparently some legislation that was attempted this past year to try to look at resolving the need of aquaculture to have bottoms that are appropriate for their growing clams, because there's so much sand movement over there. So, you know, I think we're going down the line, at least as far as I see, that there's going to be more discussion about how we come up with compromises that allows aquaculture, you know, to continue without the concerns that, okay, if SAV shows in my plot, am I going to be allowed to grow any more clams or oysters? So I think, again, what I've seen happen over the last 5 or 6 years, because of the fact that we now have a regulation that says no new aquaculture permits in areas of SAV, we've worked closely to make sure we stay within the guidelines, that if there are requests, we look at them carefully to see if we can work with the aquaculture. So, for example, there might be an area of SAV that is marginal, that is, there are a lot of sandbars where a person can work on the sandbars where there's no grass. Or, for example, in Chincoteague, there was a request by a person to have a small piece of what was an old oyster bar surrounded by grass. And so working with Hank, we came up with a solution, just said, okay, yeah, you can have this little area, but don't go into the grass. So, you know, these issues are one-on-one right now. The seaside is going to be a really interesting case because of, I know, the interest in oyster aquaculture rather than just clam culture. And so all I can say is that as we move along that line of, you know, SAV aquaculture, that and Tony, you may want to comment on any of this too, that I think we're just going to have discussions with the industry about how we work together on this.
Well, I think the point is well made about working together. I think there's some concern out there that just like that polygon that you showed, where you started out with these small plots and all of a sudden you've got the entire area filled in, I think that's the concern of some, that the entire area gets filled in and basically it displaces those that have had a successful aquaculture business in that area, and as a result of your successes and our successes to the environment, it becomes problematic as far as us being able to coexist. Mm-hmm. I think that's a lot of what the issue to be concerned about.
What I've seen in some of the permits, we take pictures, so we look at everything, and we know that, you know, the aquaculture industry has been expanding. For clams, it's pretty much intertidal.
Right.
And if you saw that polygon, there was a big area that was really bright. You know, there's no way that grass would ever grow on that intertidal bar. It's likely that we could modify the request, you know, in time and say, okay, we know that grass isn't going to grow there. It might be a perfect place for aquaculture. So we could modify that polygon. And again, that's why I'm saying that, you know, this should be a living system that we can work with aquaculture, right, with the MRC, allow both to grow concurrently.
So let me just carry that one step further. So we're looking at a piece of bottom that's, say, 6 acres that could be leased, currently not. And the fellows realize that this would be 5 acres look like they're good, as you say, intertidal bottom for clams, but there is some patches in different areas that mm-hmm. are not intertidal. You're saying that you would, in fact, lease that 6 to them, but say, hey, look, why don't you stay off, have some agreement? Is that how it would work? I just kind of
that has worked. I think Hank, you know, I've when they have a problem, I always go out and work with Hank and Paul Rogers. And we try to work with the aquaculture in terms of where they see the best area, because a lot of these places, like, for example, in Nassauwattocks, it's really muddy. And the person who wants to do aquaculture is not going to want to put their cages on mud. Yet that might be great for grass. So what we try to do is say, okay, you know, that area might be leased, but they're not even going to do anything in that area anyway, just too muddy. And that was the case in Nassauwattocks Creek.
We've got a very good relationship with JJ. He's been over backwards to help us, and we've done the same for him. When it's ever been a question, we go in the field with the applicant. And this last case in Nassauwattocks Creek, what amazed me about it is we cut a hole out in the middle. We surveyed around it. The middle was where the SAV was.
Okay.
I mean, we know, again, that's the unique aspect of the working relationship that we've been developing is that, you know, we have pictures of where this grass grows. It's not always 100% coverage. So when we draw a polygon, it's possible that there's bare areas and some areas of patchy grass, and that comes and goes. So what we try to do is just work with the MRC and the applicant, what works best for them. Because they're in these areas that are intertidal, there's no way their grass is going to grow, whereas in the shallow subtidal places, it will. So, you know, it's been a good system, and we haven't had to change any regulations. It's just been a system that I think has been a gentleman's agreement, us working with them to come up with a good solution.
Thank you.
Further questions?
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Holland.
I agree with Jim Kelly. He's got some major concerns here. Because, I mean, he's got a lot of money invested, and he's got a big agriculture industry. So do a lot of other people on the shore. So I would hope that we continue to work very closely with our agriculture,
Yes, sir. We are. I think we're all aware of the importance of aquaculture in the Virginia system, and like I said, we have been, you know, very much attuned to that. You know, this area again is historically eelgrass, and actually, some of the old maps had mapped these areas as scallop grounds. And once the eelgrass died back, they were essentially taken out of what was a scallop fishery and put into, I guess, the general. You know, system of, you know, clams or oysters, and then as oysters died out, then it became clams. Clams are dredged. Then we have clam aquaculture. Now it's, you know, developing
big oyster aquaculture.
Yeah. Well, we're well aware, and I, like I said, I think that we just need to work together on that, because if we're going to try to get the bay scallops back, which would form a whole new fishery, we're going to have eelgrass. And there are a lot of places in those areas that just don't support eelgrass. I mean, we're again learning more about that system, you know, and some of those areas may be very good for oyster culture that wouldn't be good for seagrass. And I think that's what has been developing. And again, I'm working closely with Mark Lukenbach, and his ears certainly are bent by the people in aquaculture. They know and they're concerned, so we're all ears on this.
Further questions? Okay, we've got two items. I guess we have to take action on, Jack. The first is the set-aside. It's a pleasure of the commission. Request to set aside the 507.9, continue the set-aside area. Mr. Tanker?
Move to approve set-aside area.
Is there a second to the motion? Second by Mr. Schick. Further discussion, taking into consideration everything Mr. Holland said. All in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion carries. The next item is a procurement or a funding issue. Any comment on that, Ms. McCroskey? Okay. Where's that in here, Jack? Where's the document?
Second page in the evaluation.
Okay. Okay, I found it. $23,959, does that sound?
That's with the match.
That's what the match.
That includes them, some of the match components, so it's about 21 direct.
21,000, okay.
21,000, and traditionally it's been split between the commercial fund and the recreational fund.
Okay. Matters before the commission.
Mr. Chairman, would offer a motion to accept staff's recommendation and approve continuation of funding for the propeller scar monitor.
Is there a second to the motion? Second by Mr. Tankard. Further discussion? All in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion carries. Bob, thank you so much for the good work.
Thank
you. Appreciate it. Good report.
It's a pleasure to work with you guys.
Always.
And your staff.
Thanks.
Thank you.